Hare Krishna. I'd like to welcome all of you all to the third day of the Journey of Self-Discovery course. So today we are going to discuss the topic of who am I. Before that, we'll quickly summarize whatever we discussed in the last 2 days. On day one, we discussed this topic known as the search for happiness. And we began the discussion by talking about the common things between humans and animals, which is SEED, which stands for sleeping, eating, enjoying and defending. And then we spoke about the differences between humans and animals, which is A, which stands for ability of higher inquiry, B stands for experiencing bliss, C stands for making the right choices, and D stands for determination to follow the A, B and C. Then we saw that for us to experience real happiness, one has to overcome the real problems. So we saw that there were 7 real problems: birth, old age, disease and death, and adi atmik, adi bhautik and adi devik klesh. And we saw that the world offers us 3 solutions, which are temporary solutions or stopgap measures for handling the problems that we face in life. The 3 solutions are: first one is scientific advancement in sense gratification, the second one is speculation, and the third one is superficial religious rituals. And all the 3 are temporary solutions. They don't really solve the problem, but they just give a feeling of doing away with the problem. So we saw what is a permanent solution. We saw that the permanent solution is connecting back to God. So we're looking for the right thing, which is happiness, but in the wrong place, the material world. This place is called as Dukkhalai. Dukkhalai means a place of misery. And for us to understand whether the permanent solution will work or no, that is, the connection with God will work or no, for that we need to understand if God exists. And that's when we discussed yesterday. We discussed the first is a proof for the existence of God. Under this proof for existence of God, we spoke about 4 proofs for the existence of God. The first proof is creation implies a creator. The second proof is laws imply a lawmaker. The third one is organization and order. And the fourth one is design implies an intelligent designer. And then we spoke about 2 definitions of God. The first definition of God is spec, which is supreme source of everything, supreme proprietor of everything, supreme enjoyer of everything, and supreme controller of everything. And the second definition of God is Bhagavan, which stands for somebody who is a possessor of 6 opulences in completeness. And the 6 opulences we discussed were wealth, knowledge, beauty, strength, fame, and renunciation. And then we spoke about how we can see God. So we said that there are many things in this world that we can't see, but we can see those things based on the effect that they cause. So just like strings of a pearl are hanging on a string, based the string is like the thing that holds the pearls together, but you can't always see the string. But just because you can't see the string, that doesn't mean that the string doesn't exist. So in this creation, the way in which this creation is holding on, that means practically every aspect of the creation is perfect. So the natural conclusion is that there is somebody who's making sure that the perfection is retained. So that is called as the theory of cause and effect. When you can't understand or when you can't see the cause, study the effect. And from the effect, you can naturally conclude that the cause exists. And then we spoke about 3 methods of acquiring knowledge about God. The first method we spoke was Pratyaksha Praman. Pratyaksha Praman essentially means sense perception, knowledge acquired through your senses. We discussed Pratyaksha Praman is not the best way of gaining knowledge about God. The reason is because Pratyaksha Praman has 4 defects. Our senses have 4 defects. The first defect is that our senses are imperfect. The second defect is that our senses have a tendency to be illusioned. The third defect is that our senses, we tend to make mistakes. And the fourth one is that we have a cheating propensity to cover up our mistakes. So because of these 4 defects, Pratyaksha Praman is not the perfect way of gaining knowledge about God. The second method of gaining knowledge about God we discussed was Anuman Praman. Anuman Praman essentially means guesswork. And naturally, because we have defective senses and defective understanding of life, naturally, how much ever guesswork we do, it need not necessarily be the absolute truth. Therefore, Anuman Praman also cannot be the best way of getting knowledge about God. And then the third one we discussed was Shabda Praman. Shabda Praman essentially means the word of authority. And we discussed about how scriptures are the written word of God. They are the authoritative understanding about how to acquire knowledge about God. Then we discussed why and how we can have faith in the scriptures. We discussed essentially three proofs of why we can have faith in the scriptures. The first proof we discussed was historical information being proven to be true. We discussed many facts in history where something that scriptures have mentioned thousands of years before have come to be true. So that is the first one. The second reason why we can have faith in the scriptures is because the scriptures are like instruction manuals. And they help us understand the purpose of this human body, which is like a machine, and how to utilize this machine in the best possible way. And the third reason why we can have faith in the scriptures is because scriptures have so many predictions that have come true. And because so many predictions have come true, naturally we can have faith in the scriptures. So today, before we begin today's topic, I would like to go a little more detail in this particular topic of why we can put faith in the scriptures. Because, as I said yesterday, whatever we're going to discuss ahead from now on is going to be based on this understanding that we have faith in the scriptures. Let us take an example. If a small child wants to know who his or her father is, what are the possibilities, what is the method of finding out who the father is? Any ideas? Ask the mother. Is there any other way? Medical, DNA testing. So, genetic testing is one solid way of getting proof who the father is, you know. But let us just assume that we are only testing 10% of the males in this planet. Assuming that we take only 10% of the males, it comes to about 250 million males. And assuming that the testing time to test 250 million males, each male is about 100 seconds, which is ridiculously low. But assuming like that, for 250 million males, it would take about 800 years of non-stop testing to conclude. And first of all, this kind of method is extremely expensive. You know, testing 250 million males, 800 years, first of all. After 800 years, even if you get the answer, what is the point? You know, and more than that, at least about 1,000 people will have very similar end results. So you still will not get the most accurate and conclusive answer, even if you do unlimited amount of genetic testing, which is absolutely accurate. So this is the problem with Pratyaksha and Anuman Praman. The problem with Pratyaksha and Anuman Praman is that both of them, though they seem to be promising you accuracy, though they seem to be promising you something that you can really tangibly hold on to, still there are defects, almost impossible to accurately verify. On the other hand, if we just ask the mother who the father is, her one word is more heavier than 800 years of non-stop experimentation. That is the weight of authority. That is the weight of Shabda Praman. So, can you imagine what an equation this is? Here, on one hand, you have scientific experimentation and verification process, which takes extremely long amount of time. And at the end also, it results in ambiguity of such a big variety. On the other hand, there's another process which can't verify. But because the source which is, you know, giving that information is such a reliable and heavyweight source, that one word of that person is equivalent, in fact more reliable than 800 years of non-stop testing. That is the weight of Shabda. So essentially, the scriptures are like our mother, and they give us knowledge about our father. So the weight and the word of authority of the scriptures is more heavier than all the unlimited knowledge and information put together on one side, and all the experimentation and analysis put together on that side. faith is actually an integral part of life. When somebody goes to, you know, a saloon, now most people I have seen when they visit saloons, when they visit a barber, when they, you know, when the barber is cutting their hair, they just go to sleep. They surrender, you know. Can you imagine? Do you ever ask the barber, what is your criminal record? Have you ever murdered somebody, you know? Have you done something wrong in your life? Do you have a clean sheet? We never ask the barber. In fact, can you imagine? We give our neck and in the hand of the barber, and the fellow has a knife in his hand. He can do anything. But we have so much faith that this fellow will not do anything. Right? I have not seen one person doubting a barber. When you fly in an airplane, have you ever asked the pilot, do you have a license? You never ask the pilot. You just go there, sit and go to sleep. Assuming that you know, the pilot will do a good job, he'll make sure that he doesn't go to sleep, you know. And you will not believe it. If somebody goes into an airplane when the plane is actually flying, the pilot puts the plane 90% on autopilot mode. The pilot doesn't even sit over there. He's roaming around. Now, if you don't have faith in that pilot, and just imagine while going to the toilet, you happen to see what, you know, there's no driver on the cockpit, you know, you will go crazy, right? We have faith that these people know what they're doing. And naturally, that faith works. When somebody goes for a surgery, you go to a doctor for a surgery, you don't ask a doctor, have you ever killed a patient on the table before, you know? You just have faith that this fellow is going to take care of me, and you submit yourself. They open all kinds of, you know, parts of your body, and you are absolutely helpless. So faith is an integral part of life. You can't really avoid it. So I said that the scriptures are like our mother and God is like our father. So if you want to know who our father is, the best person to reveal to us who our father is the mother. The word of the mother is more heavier than all the unlimited experimentations that science or any other process can lead you to. Unlimited Pratyaksha Praman, unlimited Anuman Praman, all that on one side, and the word of the scriptures on one side. The word of the authority is more heavier. So, just like I was telling yesterday, that to get knowledge about any field in this world, we need a reference. To get knowledge about any of the aspects of science, we need a reference. We need some standard books we can follow. Similarly, to understand and gain knowledge about God, the authoritative reference books are the scriptures. So tomorrow, we will continue this discussion by going into why there are so many scriptures in this world and why so many religions are there in this world. That we will discuss tomorrow, because tomorrow's subject matter is one God or many gods. Today, before we go into tomorrow's subject matter, one God or many gods, we have to understand something about ourselves. Unfortunately, we are all inquisitive about the whole world. We want to know about God, we want to know about other people's life, we want to know about everything. But hardly do we know ourselves enough, you know. So, unless we know ourselves properly, who we really are, till then, no point in knowing the world properly. Therefore, this whole concept, we are on this journey of self-discovery, it's essentially to first discover yourself. If you don't discover yourself, if you don't know who you really are, what is the point in knowing the whole world? And even if you know the whole world, but you don't know yourself, what is the benefit? What is the use? Therefore, today we're going to discuss this topic, who am I? And I'll tell you, this is one of the most introspective topics in this whole section. And my suggestion to all of y'all is that, please absorb yourself and hear every word as if every word can possibly change the way you think about life. And as if practically your whole direction in life depends on this particular understanding and session. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita gives such a weightage to this particular section that practically the first thing Krishna speaks in the Gita, the first message that Krishna speaks in the Gita is this. Who am I? Before Krishna addresses the whole Gita, before Krishna speaks 700 verses, the first 10 verses are this. Who am I? In fact, The whole spiritual life, our entire understanding of spirituality is based on this fact. Who am I? And if we understand this fact nicely, we can understand who God is, we can understand who others are, and we can understand every aspect of creation nicely. So my suggestion is, kindly pay attention and focus as much as possible. And when you're listening, please listen in the mood that this is about my life. This is not somebody else's life that we're discussing. This is not something, it's some information that is just going to help us become knowledgeable. This is an information that can possibly tangibly transform our life, can possibly tangibly transform the way we look at our life and the purpose of our life. Having said all that, let us just do some introspection and think. I'm sure all of us at some point of time or the other would have wondered about these facts. What is birth? Where do we come from? When a small baby is born, you take the baby in your hand, the baby is smiling, the baby is crying sometimes, moving around, moving its hands and legs. But sometimes you get surprised. Few minutes back, this baby just didn't exist only practically. And suddenly, it has got so much life, so much energy, so much movement. You tend to wonder, where has this person come from? Yes, we know it has come from the womb of the mother. But apparently, you know, it's difficult to conceive the fact that life can come in such a fascinating way. But more confusing than that is this question: what is death? Where do we go from here? Essentially, what happens after death? This is one question that every human being has at some point of time or the other. Especially when somebody who is near and dear to you leaves this world, immediately you begin to question, immediately begin to ask yourself and ask people around you, where did that person go? You almost feel so helpless, especially because the person whom you loved is still there. Apparently, the structure, the body, the person whom you loved is still there. But there is no response, there is absolutely no connection, and there is actually no feelings anymore. People treat the body as, they say, it, take it away, you know. And the person is no more called with a name, he's called as a body, right? So where does the whole personal connection go suddenly, you know? So death is sometimes a very intriguing question. It's sometimes a very intriguing phenomenon in life that practically no answers are available today. And how much ever advancement science makes, this is one question that will always bewilder a scientist. What happens after death? And what happens before birth? So, this brings us to a question. Is life after death a reality or an illusion? Is it a fact or is it a fiction? There are many people who say that life exists after death also. But there are many people who say that there is only one life, just enjoy it. So people who say there is only one life, just enjoy it, they talk about a life of no accountability. They talk about a life of joy. And when there are people who talk about the concept of life after death, they talk about a life of accountability. They talk about a life of introspection and meaning. Now the question is, it is so easy to be tempted by a life of no accountability because it seems to be a fun life, right? You don't have to think so much. You have to just enjoy and everything gets over at death. But then there are so many questions that still come up which we don't have answers to. And when such questions come up which we don't have answers to, then we start questioning, is really a possibility of life existing after death? For example, some people, as soon as they're born with phobias. Fear of heights. As soon as you go on a tall building, look down, you start, you know, feeling giddy, you start feeling dizzy. Some people have fear of water, you know. Some people have fear of blood. Some people have fear of so many, you know. I know one child, you will not believe this. There's one child, I know him from when he was about 2 years old. This boy, he loves fans. And you will not believe what kind of an addiction he has towards fans. Wherever he goes in the world, anywhere he goes, he starts looking at the fan only. The parents got bewildered. All his toys, fans. Any toy he buys, there has to be a fan in it. There has to be an aeroplane with a fan in it. There has to be a windmill type of thing with a fan in it. any toy he buys has to have a fan in it. And he's not interested in the toy, he's interested in the fan. And can you believe, such a fascination. You know, I remember we had gone for a tour and we went to an ISKCON temple. You know, I took them to Nasik to an ISKCON temple. Beautiful temple, extremely beautiful temple. But this boy is standing near an exhaust fan, looking at the exhaust fan, you know. Everybody is looking at the temple, everybody is looking at the deities and everything else, garden and so many beautiful things. But this boy is stuck at the exhaust fan only. He says, isko chalao, you know. It's just stuck there. So, why do these things happen? So, when such questions come up, then we don't have answers. And that's when this whole session makes more sense. Life after death, is it a reality or is it an illusion? So, if you just try to understand and contemplate on ourselves, if somebody asks you this question, who are you? What do we generally reply as answers? We give our name. Somebody could say, I'm a man or a woman. Somebody could say, your profession. I'm an engineer, I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm a housewife, you know, things like that. Somebody could say, I'm a mother, I'm a father, you know. Somebody could say that I'm a daughter-in-law, I'm a, you know, wife, I'm a daughter, things like that. Or somebody could say, I'm an Indian, some nationality. Somebody could say, I'm a Hindu or a Christian or a Muslim, religion. Somebody could say about caste, what caste you are. So these are the identities that we identify ourselves with. All these identities, if you study one by one, it's very interesting to understand that is there any of these identities that I just spoke about which actually we identify with? Is there any one of these identities that never changes with time? Let us take one by one. Name, does it change or does it not change? It changes for sure. When people get married, the name changes sometimes. People love to change their names automatically also, you know. When people go from one country to another, they immediately change their name. I know one lady whose name was Lakshmi Priya. When she migrated to America, her name became Lucky. Change name, right? Another person's name was Kalyana Raman. When he migrated, his name became Cal. So, name changes very often and it's very easy to change also. What about profession? Profession changes all the time, right? Somebody could be an engineer, after some time he switches to some other field, you know, possible. Can you change religion? 100%, all the time people change religion, you know. Can you change your nationality? Sure, people love to change nationality, in fact, you know. Every Indian wants a green card so that the nationality changes, right? So people love to change nationality also. What about a change of a relationship, you know? Wife or a daughter or a mother, relationship can change. 100% it can change. Nowadays, there was one boy. He filed a suit in the court. He wanted divorce from his father. And can you imagine, the court granted him divorce from his father. So relationships do change in this world. And in fact, relationships change so often today. What about sex? Can sex change? 100% it can change, you know. In fact, in Chicago, when you fill the driver's license form, there is one place which says, have you ever had a sex change before? That means that sex change is so common that they have to put it in the driver's license form also, you know. So practically all these identities that we identify ourselves with change with time. What is that identity which never changes? Let me tell you a story. One time there was a boy who got a brand new car, a brand new sports car worth about 90 lakh rupees. And he took this sports car to his college to show off to his friends and like that. So his best friend, somebody whom he loved the most, he came to him and he said, can I have a ride? I want to drive the car, you know, such a nice car. This boy, his heart was beating. He, you know, the car cost so much, you know. But he also had a relationship with this friend of his, so he couldn't say no completely. So what he did was, he said, okay, but please be careful, you know. And practically with his heart thumping, he was watching what this fellow is doing. This boy took the car out, full speed, he went out. And as soon as he went out of the gate, a big black truck came and banged into the car. This 90 lakh rupees worth car completely shattered. Completely shattered. But more than that, this boy, he was injured badly. Now, when this boy came running, he was completely confused. He saw his brand new car worth 90 lakh rupees shattered. And he saw his friend bleeding, injured. Now tell me one thing, if you were in this boy's place, what would you do first? Would you take the car to the garage first? Or would you take the friend to the hospital first? Yes? You would have helped your friend, very good.
Everybody would do that.
Yes?
It depends on how valuable, I mean, how rich I am.
How what?
It depends on how rich you are, right? How rich to buy that car.
So you might take the car to the garage.
Honestly, I would do that.
Okay, that's good. Wonderful. Yes. Okay, there can be a change in state of the boy, or the car will remain same after some time. Okay. Good. So let me tell you something very interesting for you all to reconsider your answers upon. There was a scientist called Dr. Harry Monson, who was a professor of anatomy in Illinois College of Medicine. He once did an experiment. He took a dead body of a human being and separated out all the chemicals in the body. He separated out all the chemicals in the body and put them in beakers, containers. And he found out that, you know, the whole body contained mostly water, but there was 3 pounds of calcium, you know, 1.5 pounds of phosphate, and so on and so forth. And all these chemicals, he found out the market value of these chemicals. And it's very interesting that he found out the entire market value of all the chemicals in the body put together came to about 110 rupees. Yeah, assuming that this was inflation and things like that, now it is about 210 rupees. So can you imagine the worth of the human body is 210 rupees. Now tell me, which will you take first? The car to the garage or a friend to the hospital? Friend to the hospital still? It's very interesting how human beings value something that is worthless so much. Tell me one thing, if I give this equation to a mother and tell her, see, your son is worth 210 rupees, but I'm ready to offer you 1 crore, you know, 10,000 times more, you know, will you sell your son to me? What will the mother say? Impossible. The mother will say, I cannot give my son even if you give me unlimited amount of money. Why? What is in it in that son that is more than what Dr. Monson is saying, you know, what Dr. Monson has calculated? Let us look at some emotions that people exhibit. Can you tell me what these emotions are? What is this emotion? What emotion is this boy showing? He's happy, right? What emotion is this person showing? He's frustrated. What emotion is this person showing? He is surprised, shocked. What is this emotion?
Love.
The affection, love. Now, tell me one thing. Suppose I bring all the chemicals in a human body together. All the chemicals that Dr. Monson identified. I put all the chemicals together in a bag. And now, once I put all the chemicals in the bag, can all these chemicals combine together and show all these emotions that we just saw? Can the chemicals somehow or the other smile? You know, can a bag of chemicals cry? Can a bag of chemicals show some emotions? In fact, the chemicals cannot do anything. They're just dead matter. So the question is, if that is a fact, then what is our real identity? In fact, when a person dies, the person is exactly there. All the chemicals are intact in his body. What is it that is missing that we cannot find? Actually, there are 2 identities to ourselves. One is a temporary identity or a relative identity, And the second is a real identity or a permanent identity. Each one of us in this world have two identities. And depending on the circumstances, we exhibit these different identities. 99.9999% of the time, we only use or identify with the relative identity or the temporary identity. The relative identity keeps changing. A relative identity is our name. A relative identity is our, you know, country, our occupation, our caste, our religion, our nationality, our sex, our gender. All these are what is known as relative identities. But there is a permanent identity or a real identity that never changes. In fact, it never changes no matter what external changes happen physically. What is that eternal identity that never changes? That is understanding that I am not the temporary body, but I am the eternal soul. This understanding is not just based on the scriptures, but it is based on all major religions of this world and all major philosophers of this world. The most important philosophers of this world, be it Socrates, be it Aristotle, whoever it is, they show this understanding that I am not the body, I am the spirit soul. In fact, Socrates, when he was going to be killed, people came to poison him. You know what he said? He said, first catch me, then kill me. They had caught him. He was in jail. He was with them in the prison. He had no way to escape. But still he spoke this statement. Why? Because he was convinced that you cannot catch me. The soul, the Atma, is it cannot be caught. It cannot be physically held. It cannot be captivated. And it cannot be killed. So this whole concept of we being the spirit soul and not the physical temporary body is the crux of spirituality, is the crux of the whole understanding of the Gita. In fact, unfortunately in this world, this is something that nobody accepts as reality. One time, there was a Bengali, there was one of our devotees had gone to a printing press, and there was a question paper being printed over there, you know. This was a question paper for small children in schools. And one of the questions in Bengali, in that question paper was, Ki Amar Porichai, which means, who am I? You know, that was a question for small children. So this one devotee, when he saw this, he was very intrigued that in a exam in schools, this question is being asked, who am I? So he wanted to know what is the answer that is expected in this for this question. So fortunately, the principal of the school happened to be coming there to pick up the question papers. So he asked the principal, what if you write in this paper, in this question as an answer, will you get complete marks? So this principal said, if you write your name, or if a student writes, you know, his nationality, or if he writes that he's a man or a girl, whatever, these things will give him full marks. And this devotee asked, what if he writes, I am the Atma, I am spirit soul? Principal said he'll get zero. So that means the whole understanding of life is so different from what the scriptures say and what people understand and what people perceive in this world. It is said that one time a grandmother was teaching her grandchild about life, and she taught her grandchild about life through a pencil, because children understand pencil a lot. So she started teaching the child what is life through a pencil. And actually, if you study this, these understandings of from the pencil, that is exactly what our true eternal nature is. The grandmother said that the essence of the pencil is within the pencil, not outside. And a pencil is not called a yellow pencil or a red pencil. It is called a black pencil, depending on what the color of the lead inside is. So externally, from outside, the pencil may look in so many different colors. But that's not what the pencil is recognized by. It is recognized by the color of the lead inside. So similarly, when people look at us, they may appreciate us, they may glorify us, they may, you know, praise us for whatever we're doing. But we should really understand that all that is external is not so important. If we want to remain happy in life, rather than focusing on the external, if we learn to focus on the internal aspect of life, then we'll be happy. All our life is focused on the external, ever-changing, temporary aspect of life. The relative identity that we are always identifying with. How much time in our life do we identify with our real identity which is lying within us? And only when we identify with the real identity that is lying within us, we will actually be able to progress. And a pencil, for it to really create an impact in society, the impact of the pencil can happen only when what is within comes out. Only when what is within manifests outside, only then the pencil will be able to create, leave a mark in the world. So all the temporary roles that we play in this world, we are like an actor playing roles in a drama. So all the roles that we play in a drama, at the end of the drama, all the roles dissolve. Only one role remains. Many times, people identify with their role so much, they get into the role so much. You know, like one time, there was a man who was acting as, he was such an actor that he really would get absorbed in the role too much. One time he acted as Narasingadev in a drama. And he got so absorbed in the role that he actually killed Hiranyakashipu. He actually killed the fellow who was acting as Hiranyakashipu, you know. And then the same fellow acted as Dasharath Maharaj in another drama. And when Ram was leaving, he actually died on the stage. So involved in the role practically, you know. So basically, we cannot afford to behave like that. Unfortunately, we get so much involved in our temporary role that we forget our eternal role, our eternal identity as spirit souls. So only when what is inside comes out, only then we'll be able to leave a mark in society. But for what is inside to come out, there has to be some pain. The process of sharpening a pencil is very painful to the pencil. But only when the pencil is sharpened, the lead comes out. What is within comes out. But for us, what is within us, the concept of the us being the Atma, for that to manifest outside, for us to be able to live with the fact that we are the spirit soul, there has to be a process of discipline. The process of discipline is a little painful one. But if you don't undergo pain in life, you will never be able to actually grow. And the fourth thing that we learned from a pencil is that when you write anything with a pencil, the mistakes that you make can be erased easily. So similarly, whatever we do in our life, we always get a second chance. We always get a second chance to rectify the mistakes that we have made. And finally, the last thing we learned from the pencil is that the pencil is useful depending on whose hand the pencil is in. Like one, I remember in my childhood, there was a small boy who was really naughty in our class. So one day he took a pencil and he put it on a seat, you know, and one boy came and sat on it. Oh my God, that boy practically, the lead went into him. And this boy practically had to go through surgery. Now, this fellow wanted to have fun, but at what cost? It costed that the other boy so much. So if the pencil is in the right hands, it becomes very valuable. So similarly, if our life has to become valuable, we need to have the right guidance. We need to put ourselves in the right hands so that somebody can use us to perfection. Unfortunately, people in this world don't understand this whole concept of who we really are. Most people in this world, I said 99.99% of people in this world identify themselves with the external body. And they don't even understand that they are spirit souls which is lying within the body. When we don't understand that we are spirit souls, which is our real identity, then we start identifying with the temporary false identity. And we start living a life based on the false identity. And when we live a life based on who we are not, then what are we called? We're called as crazy people. Mad people, they think they are something else only. Correct? That's why they're called a mad person. One time, the Prime Minister of India, you know, Nehru, he went to a mental asylum. And he was just speaking to the mad people there. So he met one man. So this man asked him, you know, who are you? And you know, he said, I'm the Prime Minister of India. So he said, welcome. You are going to come inside next. So no, he said, I'm really the Prime Minister. This fellow said, I also thought the same thing. Therefore, they put me inside. So when a madman thinks that he is something else, then he's put in the jail, put in a mental asylum, because he is in a different world only. Right? So if you look at mental people, they behave as if they are somebody else, right? Somebody could behave like Amitabh Bachchan, you know. Somebody could behave like somebody else, you know. They just have an altered state of understanding. But we may look at them and say they are crazy people. But actually, all of us are also crazy, equally crazy. You know why? Because we think that we are the body, but we are not the body, we are spirit souls. We are something else. So because we constantly identify with the body, because we are identifying with something that we are not, that's actually craziness. One time, there was a old lady. She bought a parrot. Very beautiful, sweet parrot. And this parrot would speak exactly what she spoke. So she loved the parrot a lot. So she wanted to buy a cage for the parrot. And she bought a cage. And she bought a golden cage. Extremely beautiful and extremely expensive cage. She put the parrot in the cage. But she fell so much in love with the cage that she completely forgot the parrot. Every day, from morning to night, she would be polishing the cage to make it shine, to make it like really look very effulgent, you know. And the parrot inside was screaming, yelling, please feed me, you know. And the lady just had no time for the parrot because she was so much enamored by the cage. And after some time, the parrot died. All of us are exactly like this old lady. Just like this old lady is taking so much care of the parrot, of the cage, and forgot the parrot within the cage. Similarly, all of us, we are taking so much care of the body, and we have forgotten completely the soul which is residing within the body. The needs of the Atma, the needs of the soul, are different from the needs of the body. Just like a car and a driver, the needs of the car is different from the needs of the driver. For the car to run, the driver has to be sitting within it. But the need of a car is petrol, but the need of the driver is food. You can't tell, the driver cannot say 1 liter petrol in the car and 1 liter petrol in my mouth, you know. The food of the car and the food of the driver is different. So similarly, the nourishment of the Atma and the nourishment of the body is different. Why do people today have so much depression? Why do people today have so much frustration in life? Why do people feel a sort of unhappiness that they cannot understand the reason for? The reason is because we have become expert in feeding the car. We have become expert in taking care of the cage. We have become expert in spending all our time investing energy taking care of the body. But we have no time for the parrot. We have no time for the driver. And we have no time for the Atma. And because we have no time for the Atma, and the Atma is screaming inside, just like this bird is screaming for lack of food. And because the needs of the Atma are not met, eventually the soul gets frustrated, depressed. And that's what manifests as an external symptom as depression. It manifests an external symptom as loneliness. It manifests in an external symptom as frustration in life and a lack of understanding of what is the purpose. So as long as we behave like this old lady taking care of the cage, in fact, the entire world is revolving around how to take good care of the cage. The whole cosmetic industry, the whole entertainment industry, the whole pharma industry is all oriented towards taking care of the cage. Every person invests how many hours in a day taking care of the cage? When we eat our food, we're taking care of the cage essentially. When we dress ourselves, we're taking care of the cage essentially. When we bathe ourselves, when we clean ourselves, we're taking care of the cage essentially. So practically all our energy and all our efforts goes in taking care of the cage. And inside, the parrot is dying. Inside, the parrot is screaming. And inside, the parrot is frustrated. The Atma, unless it gets a food which nourishes it in a different way, just like the body is being nourished, the Atma will never be really satisfied. The question now is, what is the proof for the existence of the soul? We are saying so many things that the soul exists. We are saying so many things that we are not the body, we are spirit souls. The question is there tangible proof that we are not the body, we are spirit soul? What is the proof? What is the tangible proof that we can actually understand that we are not the body, we are spirit soul? Only if we are convinced of the fact that we are not the body, we are spirit soul, we will start acting on the level of the spirit soul, right? Unfortunately, in this world, for us to be able to accept the fact that we are not the body, but we are spirit soul, we need conviction. Today's world is such a mechanical world that it's almost always assumed that what you see externally is a reality. What you see is what is fact. But actually, not all the time what we see is a fact. Not all the time what we see is reality. There are realities that we can't see also. Therefore, for us to be able to see those realities that we can't see, we need some logical proofs also. So, I'm going to share with you all three proofs for the existence of the soul. The first proof is known as logic. So, under logic, I'm going to give you all many logics of how we can understand that we are not the body, but we are spirit souls. The first logic is common sense. When a person dies in a family, what happens? Everybody in the family is crying that the person is dead. If a husband dies, the wife is crying. If the wife dies, the husband is crying. Now tell me one thing. The person whom you loved, the person whom you lived with, the person whom you have, you know, shared your life with, that person is still there. The person who died is still there. Why do we cry? Why do we say that person is dead? When a person dies, what do you say? How do you say that the person died? He passed away, right? He expired. He left the body. These are the words that we use to say that he, you know, he died. What is the meaning of he passed away? The person who passed away is still there. The person you say is your friend or is your husband or your wife, whatever your relative is still there. Why do you say that he passed away? It means that something in him has passed away, has gone away. He left the body. Something in him has left the body, right? You tell a wife who has spent 30 years with her husband and the husband dies. You tell her, you spent 30 years already anyways, right? You spend one more night with him after he dies. You see the reaction. Impossible. Why? The same person, you remained 30 years alone with that person. One more night, what is the problem in remaining alone? Nobody will do it. Fearful. Because the person whom they spend their time with is no more there. The Atma has gone. The soul has left the body. He has passed away. And because he has passed away, that body is only dead matter. I'll give you another logic. This is known as introspection. Just think about it as I ask you all questions. Can somebody come here just for a minute? One or two questions I want to ask. Not very tough questions, just simple questions. Can somebody volunteer? Come. So I'm going to ask him some questions, okay? And these questions are really tough questions and I'm sure he will not be able to answer them. But all of you all, as I'm asking him questions, think about the answers to these questions, okay? So can you point out your head? Wow, he answered it. I thought he won't be able to answer. Can you point out your hand? Okay. Can you point out your nose? Can you point out your body? Okay. So he's pointed out to his whole body, okay? Can you point out yourself? So, if you notice what is happening, think about it. Thank you very much. Give him a good hand. So, if you just think about what I just did with him, it is very easy for us to point out to our head. This is my head. Very easy to point out to my hand or my, you know, different parts of my body. It is very easy to point out to the body also. But if I say, point out to yourself, the most natural thing we do is, this is myself. But just now we said, this is my body. Why are we saying, this is myself also? Right? Let me give you another understanding. If I say, this is my watch, what does it mean? It belongs to me. It also means something else. It also means that this watch and me are two different things. Right? When I say, this is my watch, that means I am not the watch. This watch belongs to me. So when I say, this is my body, what does it mean? It means the body belongs to me. It means that I am not the body, I am the owner of the body. So it means essentially that I am separate from the body. If I say this is my body, if it is not the fact, if this is the body, if I am the body, then I should say me body. Why do we say my body? The very fact that we say this is my body, common sense logic, introspection just brings you to the understanding that the body and me are two different things. Another logic is the theory of cause and effect again. The theory of cause and effect says, suppose you see a car moving at full speed, and what do you conclude when you see the car moving at full speed? The natural thing we conclude is that somebody is driving the car. It's the most natural thing. Similarly, when we see that this body is moving, it is working, it is functioning, the natural conclusion is that there is some driver that is driving the body. There is some driver that is actually making the body function. The body is exactly like a car. The car has headlights, we have two eyes. The car has, you know, tires, we have hands and legs. The car drinks fuel, we also eat food. The car has a horn, we have a mouth to speak. So exactly like how the car functions, exactly the similar way our body functions. And just like the car cannot move without a driver, our body cannot move without the soul. So the first understanding or the first proof for the existence of the soul is logic. So under logic we saw common sense, we saw introspection, and we saw the theory of cause and effect. The second proof for the existence of the soul is known as science. So here I'm going to share with you all two things that science has to share about the concept of we being the spirit souls and not the body. This is absolutely nothing connected with spirituality. It is considered connected with pure science. There is a man called Dr. Michael Sebaum. This man, he did so many experiments on people who have had near-death experiences. Hundreds and hundreds of cases of people who have had near-death experiences. And almost in every case, Michael Sebaum has seen a very similar and a very common type of thread that runs through the case. Almost everybody who has had near-death experiences recalls the fact that they say that we have seen the body ourselves from outside ourselves. Like there was a man who had a near-death experience on an operation table. He was being operated, and as he was being operated, he left his body. And this man, he claims to have seen the entire operation from above. He can tell you exactly who did what in the operation. It's the doctors, when they heard this, they were shocked. They said, how did you know all the details? This man said, I saw myself being operated. So they felt that he saw some television or some, you know, CCTV recording, something like that. But they realized that he had seen none of those things. And then they did a detailed experimentation of what he really saw. And this man could give accurate details of what happened in the operation, the whole operation procedure, couple of hours of operation procedure. Michael Sebaum, he has many, many such stories to share of people who have had near-death experiences. There was one man who was admitted in hospital for a heart attack. And while he was in the hospital, you know, he was in his room, he suddenly felt that he was flying. And he was flying out of the hospital window. And he was flying upwards, you know. So, after some time, when he had this experience, he suddenly felt himself pulled back and he got up. And he was shocked that he had such an experience. So he went and told the doctors that this is what I went through. I saw myself flying out of the window. The doctor said, you're hallucinating, you know. They wanted to give him some antidepressant drugs and things like that just to shut him off. This man said, no, I saw everything and I remember everything. The doctor said, what is the proof? And this man, he said, when I was flying out of the window, I saw a tennis shoe lying on one parapet in such a corner of the hospital that nobody from inside can see. And they, you know, ran around and actually tried to verify whether this man saw the tennis shoe. And to their shock, he actually saw the tennis shoe, and the tennis shoe was exactly there where he had said it would be. So there are so many experiments like this so many experiences like this of people who have had near-death experiences. I'm sure amongst y'all also, you may know somebody who have had near-death experiences. I myself know one person. He didn't come here. I could have called him actually. This man, his grandfather went through a near-death experience very recently. And he has a vivid understanding of how he saw himself, you know, coming out. One friend of mine who had gone through a minor surgery. The doctors, and this happened somewhere in America, the doctors made a mistake. They gave the anesthesia in a wrong way. And the result of that was that this man died. He actually died. And the doctors, they were really panicking because this man came for a minor surgery, and the result of their negligence was he died. And they started rushing him to another hospital. You know, he was like, when they found that he is on his verge of dying, they rushed him to another hospital. On the way, this man died. And this man, the doctors didn't realize he died, but this man, he recollects that he felt himself being pulled into a tunnel. He was flying at the speed of the wind into the tunnel. And he was flying. And at some point of time, suddenly, he jerked and he came back to his external consciousness. This man, till that point of time, he had no faith in this concept of the Atma. His wife was connected to the Hare Krishna movement very strongly. She was already attending the Journey of Self-Discovery and she already had started coming to the Gita classes. But this man had absolutely no faith and he had no wanted, desire to go there also. But after this particular incident happened, when he got up, the doctors, you know, they were also shocked. What exactly happened? They didn't understand, you know. This man never told his wife what happened. He never told the doctors what happened. He never ever told the doctors that he went through this whole phase of near-death experience. But when he came back, the first thing he asked his wife is, please take me to that course. I want to sit and attend. I want to hear and understand what exactly is this soul thing. So, there are many people who have gone through these near-death experiences. This is one of the proofs of science. Dr. Michael Sebaum, you can Google him and you can find out more information about many of the case studies that he has gone through. There is something more intriguing. This is the story of, this is the person named Dr. Ian Stevenson. This man, he has done at least 3,000 case studies of people who have had past life memories. People who remember their previous life in great details. I'll tell you one or two stories. In fact, there was one boy whose name is Deep Kapadia. We used to call him here for the Journey of Self-Discovery courses when we were discussing this particular topic to share his personal experience. You know, now of course he's grown up. He's probably about 30 or 35 now. But this experience that he had happened when he was a five-year-old child in his childhood. This boy, Deep Kapadia, born in a Gujarati family, born in Bombay, never ever left Bombay. This boy, one day, he just started speaking a different language. He started speaking Marwadi language. The parents were shocked. A five-year-old boy, always within the home, never really left the home, never really left Bombay. He started speaking in another language. And he started telling, my house is in Udaipur. The parents were quite shocked. They were thinking initially that he is joking, you know. He is, you know, children tend to speak anything. So they were just neglecting him. But this boy was consistently talking about being in Udaipur, consistently talking about I want to go to my family, consistently talking in a different language. So they got completely bewildered. So they called the father of this boy, called his brother, and he said, this is how my son is behaving. And immediately the brother said, we should involve Ian Stevenson, his team. Because he knew about these past life memories and many of such incidences. So they called up Ian Stevenson's team. There was a lady called Satwant Pasricha. She is even now in Nimhans in Bangalore. You know, she takes care of the psychiatric ward there and all the psychological cases. So Ian Stevenson and Satwant Pasricha, they came to the house of this family. They saw this boy, and this boy was talking, you know, fluently in another language. So they started interviewing the boy, and they started finding out details. The boy didn't know much. but he knew certain details accurately. So they said, it's worth experimenting, finding out what exactly is going on. So they decided to take the family to Udaipur. So they took the entire family, the boy, the mother and the father, and Ian Stevenson and his assistant, they all went to Udaipur by train. And as the train was approaching Udaipur, this boy started telling names of stations, which is going to come, you know. People were shocked. I mean, this boy had never left Bombay. And what to speak of knowing names of stations of another state totally, right? And when the train reached the destination, this boy got down on his own and started walking. And all of them started following him. This boy climbed up a bridge. He went across the bridge. He got down on the platform. He walked out. He started bargaining with the Tangawala. You know, started bargaining rates with the Tangawala. So these people were shocked what this boy is doing, you know. And they climbed into the Tanga. The Tanga took them somewhere. It got down somewhere. And this boy started walking. They were just following him, you know. And this boy is just confidently walking. 5-6 year old boy, you know. And he walked and stood outside a house. And he started touching the wall of the house. So then they realized something is wrong here. And they went inside and asked the people in the house. They asked some neighbors actually. Was there a door over here? And the neighbor said yes. There was a door over here. And because some wrong things happened in the house, in the family, they changed the door, the location of the door, to another side. And then they went to the other side. And they opened the door. There was a family, many people in that place, almost like 10-15 people in that house. And this boy, 5-6 year old boy, he pointed out to one man, 22-23 year old man, you know, and he said, "This is my son." Everybody was shocked. 5 year old boy pointing to a 22 year old guy and saying, "This is my son." That fellow, he freaked out. He said, "What's going on?" You know, they thought somebody is going to loot them or something, you know, some cheating type of case. And then this 22-year-old man, he asked, you know, he said, "If you are my father, tell me what is my nickname my father used to call me by." Immediately he said, he told the nickname. This man was shocked. And then he said, "My father had a gun. And his gun was kept in a particular secret place that nobody ever knew. You find that gun, then I'll accept that you are my father." This boy, he climbed up a floor. He opened a cupboard. He took out a small key from one corner of the cupboard. Then he went and opened another door. And inside they found that gun. And then the whole story was revealed that this boy, in his previous life, he was a guard in the Udaipur palace. And somehow certain things happened and he was killed over there. And you know, that particular door which this boy opened, he had not only the gun, but a lot of artifacts of the Udaipur palace also. So that's how this whole case was resolved as a case of reincarnation. Of course, over a period of time, this boy, he forgot all the details, you know, and he forgot his previous life. But in that small span of his childhood, in those few years of his childhood, very distinct memories of his past life were there. And this is just one of them. There are thousands of such cases, not hundreds, thousands of such cases, not only in India, across the world, of people who have had past life memories. You can Google Ian Stevenson and find out all details about him. You want videos, I can share with you all videos of people whom Ian Stevenson has interviewed and you know, found out. Of course, Ian Stevenson, he died about 2 years back. But the experimentation that he did was substantial, and so many tangible proofs that he accumulated about past life memories. The third proof for the existence of the soul is based on the scriptures. The Bhagavad Gita talks about two types of reincarnation. The Bhagavad Gita says there is an internal reincarnation and an external reincarnation. Internal reincarnation, Gita says, the verse of the Gita 2.13, Dehinosmeta dehe komaram yovanam jara tata dehantara praptir dhirastatrana muyate. Krishna says in the Gita that just like a person passes from boyhood to youth and from youthhood to old age, similarly, the soul passes from this body to another at the time of death. And Krishna says, dhirastatrana muyate. He says, an intelligent, sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Essentially, this is what is known as internal reincarnation. Internal reincarnation means, in our life, science has proved it, that every 7 years, every cell in the body changes. So practically, every 7 years, we have a new body. Suppose somebody lives for 70 years. That means, in the span of 70 years, 10 times he has changed his body already. So what is the difficulty in understanding and accepting the fact that at the time of death, he's changing his body again? If you take a photo of yourself now, if you take a photo of yourself 10 years before, and if you take a photo of yourself in your childhood, you will not be able to believe that it is the same person. Practically, I know people who love to post their childhood photos on Facebook, on WhatsApp and things like that. Why? Because they themselves are shocked. I was like this. They're bewildered, The only person who can verify and prove, tell you that yes, you are the same person as the mother who has been seeing all the changes. But otherwise, if anybody else sees, they will never really believe the same person. That means, within this lifetime itself, we are changing our body so many times. That is known as internal reincarnation. And then there is something known as external reincarnation. Krishna says in the Gita, Vasamsi jirnani yata vihaya, navani grananti naroparani. Tata sharirani vihaya jirnani, anyani samyani navani dehe. Krishna says that just like when a person is wearing old cloth, when the cloth gets worn out and it gets useless, you remove that cloth and throw it and wear a fresh cloth. Similarly, when the body gets old and worn out, it is useless to reside in, the Atma throws the body out and gets a new body. What is the difficulty in believing this? So Krishna, he brings these two concepts of internal reincarnation and external reincarnation. So essentially, these are three proofs for the existence of the soul. First is logic. We spoke about the concept of common sense. He passed away. The person who passed away is still there. Who has passed away? The Atma has passed away. Then we spoke about the concept of inner logic. We spoke about introspection. And in introspection, we spoke about how we say this is my body, which means the body and me are two different things. That means I am not the body, but I am residing in the body. And the third logic we spoke about is the theory of cause and effect. Just like a car cannot move without a driver, similarly the body which is matter cannot move without a driver which is the spirit, Atma. And then we spoke about, after logic, we spoke about science. Two things, near-death experiences, experiments by Dr. Michael Sebaum of many, many cases of people who have had near-death experiences and they have claimed to be seeing themselves from somewhere outside. And we spoke about past life memories, experiments by Dr. Ian Stevenson. We spoke about the case of Deep Kapadia and so many stories of people who have had past life memories. And then we spoke about another proof through the scriptures. The Bhagavad Gita speaks about two types of reincarnation, internal and external reincarnation. The question that many people ask is that, I will accept the fact that we are spirit soul, provided you show me. Can you show me that I am the Atma? Or can you show me any Atma? If you show me some Atma, then I will believe that Atma exists. The Chanakya Niti gives a very beautiful shloka. This shloka says that, can we see fragrance in a rose or ittar in a rose? We can't. We can smell it, but we can't see it. But if you want to see that fragrance or you want to see the ittar, there is a process. If you follow the process, surely you will be able to see that, the fragrance actually there, right? Can we see oil seeds? We can't see. But if you are ready to undergo a process, if the oil seeds go through a process, then surely you will be able to see the oil. Can we see fire in wood? We can't see. But if the firewood goes through a process, you can see fire. Can we see ghee in milk? We can't see. But when the milk goes through a process, you will surely be able to see. Can we see jaggery in sugarcane? We can't see. But if the sugarcane goes through a process, surely you will be able to see jaggery. Similarly, there is a process to see the soul. The question is, are we ready to follow the process? Many people don't want to follow any process and they want to say, I want to see the soul. How is it possible? If experiments in science don't allow you to see anything without the whole process, How can the Atma be seen without following a process? So, one time, one of our devotees was presenting this concept in a college. And he was talking about this concept of how we are the spirit souls and not the body. One boy, he got up and he said, if you can show me the soul today, now, then I will shave my head and join the temple with you. Everybody in the college, they started clapping their hands. They said, oh, this person can't answer this question now. This devotee gave a very interesting answer. He said, in biology, when you want to see a microorganism, what do you use? You use a microscope. In chemistry, when you want to test the litmus, the alkalinity, acidity, what do you use? You use a litmus paper. In physics, when you want to measure small distances, what do you use? You use a vernier calipers. So, he was asking this very logical question. Can we use the vernier calipers to see a microorganism? Can we use a litmus paper to measure distances? Or can we use a microscope to measure the alkalinity, acidity of a substance? You can't. The apparatus and the procedure of one science cannot be used to measure and to see the result of another science. Every science has its own apparatus and its own procedure. You cannot expect to see the result of one science using another science. Similarly, if you want to see the soul, there is a science. There is an apparatus and there is a procedure. If you are ready to use that apparatus of that particular science and the procedure of that particular science, you will be able to see the soul. And he said, if you can measure distances using a microscope, then I will be able to show you the soul with your eyes. Otherwise, you have to be ready to undergo a process and use a particular apparatus which is recommended by that science. You cannot replace or you cannot exchange the procedure and apparatus of one science to find the resultant of another science. So essentially, the seeing the Atma and experiencing the Atma is possible, provided we are ready to undergo a process and provided we are ready to undergo using a particular apparatus. If you are ready to do it, guaranteed you will be able to see the soul and you will be able to experience the soul. So therefore, unless we have that understanding and faith, we will not be able to understand anything else further. So let me ask you another question. According to y'all, what do you think, how many bodies do we have? Any guesswork, how many bodies we have? Five bodies. Okay, wonderful. Somebody said one body. Anything else? We have seven chakras. So does it mean we have seven bodies? Something like that. Chakras. Okay. We have three bodies. Okay. Anything else? Any other number? Good. So somebody says we have seven bodies. Somebody says we have five bodies. Somebody says three. Somebody says one. Anybody said two? Nobody said two. Okay, good. So essentially, the scriptures say that all of us have three bodies. And how it happens and how, what is exactly these three bodies, we will see now. The first body that we have, these bodies are in the form of layers. Just like you have a hand and you wear a gloves on the hand, a latex gloves, right? And on top of the latex gloves, you wear a cricket gloves or a boxing gloves on it. What happens? Your hand is within, the latex gloves is on top of it. And on top of that, there's a cricket gloves, right? So similarly, we have three layers to ourselves. That means we have three bodies. The first body is known as the gross body or the sthula sharir. This gross body is made up of five substances. Earth, water, fire, air and ether. This is the Panchamahabhut that you are talking about. So essentially, the outer layer is known as the gross body or sthula sharir. All of us, what we identify ourselves with is at this level. So we consider ourselves to be the gross body, which is like a suit. In a three-piece suit, we have an external suit. Inside the gross body is a second layer, which is known as the subtle body. or the sukshma sharir. Sukshma sharir is made up of three things: the mind, the intelligence, and the false ego. This is known as a subtle body. This is within the gross body. So the gross body is external, which we can see. The subtle body is within the gross body, which we can't see. But the subtle body is one of the most important aspects of ourself. We will discuss about how the subtle body functions a little later. And then inside the subtle body is what is known as the spiritual body, or the Atma, or the spirit soul. So the subtle body and the gross body, the sukshma sharir and the stula sharir, they are both known as the inferior energy of God. Inferior energy. And the spirit soul or the Atma is known as the superior energy of God. So the three bodies are like a computer. Just like in a computer, the gross body is like the hardware of the computer. You can see it easily. The subtle body is like the software of the computer. You can't see it, but it is all over there. And the soul is like electricity. Without electricity, software, hardware, both are there useless. Without the electricity, neither the software nor the hardware will be useful. So the software cannot be seen. Why? The hardware can be seen, but the software cannot be seen because the software exists on another plane. It exists on a different dimension. So similarly, the gross body can be seen because it is within the three dimensions. But the subtle body is on a different dimension. So you can't see it. There are many things in this world that you can't see. And just because you can't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It exists. But your eyes have a limitation of seeing it. So the software resides in the memory of the computer, of the hardware. But it impacts all over the computer. Similarly, the subtle body, it exists within the gross body, but it impacts the entire gross body. So the subtle body covers the Atma and it is within the gross body. So essentially, the subtle body is something that always travels with the soul everywhere. So the function of these three things, I'll just mention, and then we'll go and discuss how they all integrate and function. As I said, the subtle body is made up of three things: the mind, the intelligence, and the false ego. I'll tell you what are the properties of these three things. The gross body, of course, we understand is made up of earth, water, fire, air, ether. Dr. Monson, what he separated out was the gross body. All the experimentation that he did, which he says 110 rupees or 210 rupees, whatever it is the value of the gross body. But he cannot measure the value of the subtle body, what to speak of measuring the value of the spiritual body, which is within us. The value to a human being comes by the existence of the subtle body and the spiritual body. So the mind, intelligence, and false ego, these are the symptoms or the roles of the mind, intelligence, and false ego. The role of the mind is thinking, willing, and feeling. The mind is a reservoir of thoughts. The mind is a reservoir of experiences, and the mind is a reservoir of desires. All the experiences that you have in life, all the impressions that you get in life are stored in the mind. The mind is like a sponge. Just like in a sponge, if you keep putting drops of ink one by one, one by one, one by one, slowly the sponge becomes completely filled by ink. Then you squeeze the sponge, what will come out? Not honey. Ink will come out. Similarly, the mind is filled with experiences. The mind is filled with impressions. All the impressions of your life are stored in the mind. And those impressions are carried with the spiritual body from one life to another. Why do people remember certain incidents that have happened in the past? Because the mind travels with the spiritual body. The mind travels with the Atma. The subtle body travels with the Atma with the death of the gross body. When the gross body dies, only the gross body is dead. But the subtle body and the Atma travel to the next destination, to the next body. So the mind holds thoughts, desires, experiences, and it is a storehouse of the concept of thinking, willing, and feeling. All the experience, impressions that you have in your life are stored in the mind as information. The role of the intelligence is three things. The intelligence does the role of discrimination, decision making, and determination. This is the role of the intelligence. The intelligence is the one that tells you what to do and what not to do. The mind is the one that tells you what it feels like doing. The mind never tells you what is right and what is wrong. Mind only tells you what it feels like doing. It only talks based on feelings. Therefore, if you listen to the mind, you're dead. But if you listen to the intelligence, you get direction. So now, for us to understand the whole concept of mind intelligence, we need to see a model. And this model is a powerful model for us to understand how our life functions. But before I understand the model, let me explain a little bit about the false ego also. I said there is a third thing, which is the part of the subtle body known as the false ego. This false ego is the most dangerous part of the subtle body. Because this is the one that binds us to the gross body. Yesterday, when I was talking about attachments, when I was talking about the process of death, I was telling you that the pain of death is so strong because you feel so strongly attached to the body. That attachment is created by the false ego. The false ego, what it does is that it binds the subtle body, the spirit soul, through the subtle body with the gross body. The spirit soul, the Atma, starts identifying so much with the gross body that it feels, if the gross body is dying, I am dying. That strong bonding and attachment is created by the false ego. The false ego is like a, sticking a fevicol or something like that, you know. Something that sticks the two bodies together. So the false ego does that role. So just to help us understand this whole body, mind, intelligence concept and the soul concept, there is a beautiful analogy that is given in the Shveteshvatara Upanishad. This analogy is an analogy of a chariot. So the body is compared to the chariot, and the five horses are compared to the five senses that we have: the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the ears, the tongue, and the sense of skin, the touch. So these are the five horses, and the five horses are held together by the help of a reins. The reins is the mind, and the reins is in the hands of a chariot driver, and the driver is the intelligence. And the passenger who is sitting in the vehicle is compared to the Atma, the spirit soul. The way this function, the whole chariot functions, is that the horses go in the direction, ideally, this is how it's supposed to function. Then I'll tell you how it really functions in our life. Then you'll understand why we go through problems in life. Ideally, the passenger is supposed to tell the driver where he wants to go. And the driver is supposed to control the reins, the mind, and tell the horses to go in a certain direction, depending on the desire of the passenger. But unfortunately, in our life, that doesn't happen. The five horses are extremely powerful horses, and all the five have a mind of their own. They have a desire of their own, and all the five horses are drunk, absolutely drunk, and extremely powerful horses. The eyes want to see something beautiful all the time. The ears simultaneously want to hear something beautiful all the time. The tongue wants to taste something nice all the time. The sense of touch wants to touch something soft all the time. The senses are crazy. They are drunk, they are crazy, they are intoxicated, and they are strong. With five strong horses, all of them want to go in five different directions. Unfortunately, the intelligence is very weak. Thin fellow. Can you imagine a thin driver trying to drive five powerful horses who want to go in five different directions? What will happen to the passenger inside? The whole thing will go for a toss. I'll give you an example. When people go to movie theaters, what exactly happens? Why do people go to a movie theater for? They want to see something nice. They want to see beautiful visions like that. But if you go to a movie theater, there's no sound, it's not so much fun. So you need good quality sound also, so that the ears are also having, you know, nice experience. But when you go to a movie theater and your ears are having nice experience, your eyes are having nice experience, but the seat in which you're sitting is hard, difficult to sit for a long period of time. So you need soft seat also. So your sense of touch also is, you know, feeling nice. And then, what is a movie without popcorn? You have to eat something also, so that your tongue also experiences something nice, right? And then, you know, when all this is there, if 1,000 people are there in a movie theater and it starts stinking, you will not have fun. So you need perfume. Your nose also needs to smell nicely, you know. So can you imagine in one movie theater what is happening? All the five horses are running wild, five different directions. Absolutely crazy. And the intelligence is supposed to be the driver has no strength at all. Extremely thin intelligence. Therefore, the horses are going in wild directions and the Atma is feeling frustrated. Why do people go through depression in their life? Why do people go through frustration and anxiety in their life? Because their horses are wild. The senses are wild. And as long as the senses are wild and the senses are not controlled by the intelligence, which is has to be powerful, the horses, the chariot is going to go in the wrong direction. And the chariot will always feel, the passenger will always feel frustrated. He'll always feel misguided. He'll always feel that he has no control over his life. Just to help us understand how the mind and intelligence function together, I'll give you an example. This example holds, when I tell you this example, you will find this happening at every phase in your life. Practically from morning to night, this is what happens. Mind intelligence dialogues. This is the only thing that happens from morning to night in our life. And most of the time, the mind always wins. And our intelligence doesn't speak at all. The intelligence is weak, the intelligence is dumb, and the intelligence is dull in our lives. So just imagine a boy who is going to a college studying for exams. And this guy, you know, just like a youth college going boy, bunked all classes, never attended properly, and last minute studies. So this fellow, the exam is next day morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. And this guy is gathering his notes, you know, today morning. After somehow they are accumulating all notes and he's ready to study. He studies for a couple of hours till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And is suddenly from within him, a voice starts speaking. The voice tells him, enough, bahut ho gaya, band karo padhai. And within him, another voice speaks up. You fool, all semester long you have not done anything. At least today study. Not even half the portion is over. And this fellow continues studying for some more time. And after a couple of hours, now it's 9 o'clock in the night. Studied for almost like 10 hours. The first voice opens up again. He's impossible. I can't handle anymore. I quit. The second voice tells him, come on. Still 1/4 of the portion is left. You will fail surely tomorrow. The first voice tells, I can't take it anymore. The second voice says, okay, no problem. If you can't take it anymore, you can sleep, but on one condition. The condition is that, put an alarm, 2 o'clock in the morning. And the first voice says, no problem, anything, but I want to sleep now. Have you all experienced these voices in your life? You know, two voices speaking, one voice telling you, do this, another voice telling you, do that. The first voice that functions based on thinking, willing and feeling is the voice of the mind. The mind will only tell you what I feel. I don't feel good. I don't feel nice. I don't feel happy. I feel good doing this, you know. That voice is the voice of the mind. And the voice that tells you in terms of discrimination, this is right and that is wrong, that is the voice of the intelligence. If this boy listens to the voice of the intelligence and in any way he decides to put the alarm, goes to sleep. So the mind, it directs the senses. Once the mind gets an instruction of the intelligence, it directs the senses. The eyes look for the alarm clock. The hands go and fetch the alarm clock. They set the alarm and he jumps into the bed, goes to sleep. Next day morning, 2 o'clock, alarm rings, ring, ring. And suddenly voice comes up from within. The second voice says, get up. The first voice says, 2 minutes. Now, if you listen to the first voice, fail. If you listen to the second voice, you will get up and you will study. These are the voices that exist all our life, practically. The voice of the mind and the voice of the intelligence. The voice of the intelligence is the voice that helps us discriminate, take decisions, and have determination to follow certain things in life. And the voice of the mind is based on thinking, willing and feeling. Just the concept of what feels good. So, if the soul has to have a direction, we have to listen to the voice of the intelligence. We have to empower the intelligence. And how to empower the intelligence is what we'll be discussing on day 6. The day 6 is going to be how the intelligence can be empowered. Unless the intelligence is empowered, you cannot function nicely. The body will go topsy-turvy, you know, and you will completely lose focus on what is the purpose and goal and aim of life. And as long as we learn the existence of these mind-intelligence dialogues, that's when we can understand that the subtle body exists. So most people all that psychiatry talks about, all the psychology talks about, it does talk about the mind, but it doesn't talk about the existence of the intelligence, and it doesn't talk about the existence of the false ego, and it definitely doesn't talk about the existence of the Atma, right? So this model is a very powerful model to understand how our internals function and what direction our life should be going in. So we as spirit souls, when we take control over the way our life functions, then we have certain direction. But unfortunately, when we don't even recognize that we are the Atma, but we think that we are the body, life functions in a totally different way. So just before I end, I'm going to have some FAQs. These are some questions that all of you all will have right now in your minds. So I'm going to answer many of the questions so that we have lesser questions to handle later. And these are questions that are commonly thought. The first question is, does the Atma or the soul have a form? The answer is that matter is formless. Atma gives form to matter. As soon as the Atma leaves the body disintegrates. In a matter of seconds, the body starts disintegrating, right? We don't find a body lasting even for a few days, few hours also, you know. The right from the second the Atma leaves the body, the disintegration process starts. That means when the Atma enters the body, the process of, you know, growth starts. The process of creation starts. And when the Atma leaves the body, the process of disintegration starts. That means if Atma is giving form to matter, how can something that does not have form gives form to something that, you know, give form to something else? So form always gives rise to another form. So the Atma does have a form. But in this world, the Atma takes a form of a seed. But in the spiritual world, the Atma has a complete, full-fledged, beautiful form. It is known as Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means eternal. Chit means full of knowledge. And Ananda means full of bliss. The property of the Atma, the nature of the Atma is Sat Chit Ananda. It is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. The Atma is actually eternally happy. Can you imagine? All of us are searching for happiness outside. But the nature, the very nature of ourselves is Ananda. So the Atma gives form to matter. The second question is the soul in every body the same? We are 40-50 of us sitting over here. All our souls are one? No. The souls are all different. Krishna says in the Gita, Natve vaham jatunasham natme neme janadipa. He says that each individual has a separate spirit soul, separate identity. Twins whose external bodies look exactly same have two Atmas, have different Atmas in them. So every body has an individual soul, and you cannot lose your individual existence. Many people feel at death all souls merge together. No, never do they merge together. Krishna says in the Gita, he's telling Arjun that you, me and all these kings have existed in the past, are existing now and are going to exist in the future also. That means it's not that these Atmas merge together and lose their identity. They never lose their identity. They retain the individuality forever. The next question is, where does the Atma reside? Where is the place of residence of the Atma? The scriptures explain that the Atma resides in the region of the heart. It resides in the region of the heart. Now, people, when they say, when you hear that, the question is, what happens during heart transplant? Intelligent question. So essentially what happens is that, now you're all sitting on a chair. If you get up from the chair, I take your chair away and bring another chair and put it in, what will happen? You sit back on the chair. Similarly, during heart transplant, the Atma gets up. The chair is taken out, a new chair is put. As simple as that. The Atma is not the heart. The Atma resides in the heart. The heart is only a seat for the Atma to reside. And similarly, just to give you a deeper understanding of this fact, we have some exalted doctors over here. They can, you know, vouch for what I'm saying. The heart beats. And as long as the heart beats, the body continues functioning. As soon as the heart stops beating, it's death. So essentially, when the heart beats, what exactly happens? The muscles are contracting and expanding. because the heart muscles are contracting and expanding, the blood is being pumped in, pumped out, right? And how do the muscles get the power to contract and expand? They get the power to contract and expand based on nerves that give them electric signals. And where do these nerves get the electric signals from? It's from a small part of the heart, which is known as the pacemaker. And the pacemaker is the place from which electrical signals are generated. The question now is, this is a question that science has not been able to answer till now. Where does the pacemaker get its energy from? The pacemaker gets its energy from the Atma. Essentially, even when you replace a pacemaker with another artificial pacemaker, still that pacemaker has to be driven by electrical signals. The Atma is the one that actually drives the pacemaker to function. Right? Make sense? What do you think? What? So is there any scientific understanding of how the pacemaker gets its electrical signals from? There is? What is the understanding? Where does it get electrical signal from?
It's a tissue.
Right.
Because the tissue in the heart.
Yeah.
So every tissue in the heart gets energy.
From where? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, so energy is produced. ATP is the form of energy which is utilized by the body.
So that is there. But then, why does the pacemaker stop functioning at a certain point of time? The energy is still there in the body. Food is still eaten, right? A dead person, 5 minutes before he eats food, his energy is still there. If energy was actually the source of giving strength and signals to the pacemaker, why is sometime energy stops to the pacemaker? Make sense?
Yeah.
So that's the point. The point is, on a gross level, you can explain everything. But on a deeper, subtle level, at some point you get stuck. At some point, there is no specific understanding of how it functions. And that's where the scriptures come in picture. That's where the knowledge of the Gita comes in picture. Krishna very clearly talks about how the energy to the pacemaker comes from the Atma, from the spirit soul. So the drive, where does the soul reside essentially? It resides in the region of the heart. And as soon as the soul leaves, the first thing that stops is the pacemaker stops. So the soul... The question is the soul destroyed at the time of death? The answer is that the soul does not get destroyed at the time of death. In fact, the soul cannot be destroyed by weapons. The soul cannot be burnt by fire. The soul cannot be wet by water. The soul is eternal and it cannot be destroyed. So the soul is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. So essentially, when I was talking to you about the subtle body and the gross body, the time of death, when the person dies, when the Atma essentially comes out of the body, the Atma comes out along with the subtle body. The gross body dies, but the subtle body travels with the Atma to the next destination. Therefore, as I said, mind is the storehouse of thoughts, experiences, desires, right? So the Atma, which is embedded within the subtle body, travels along. And that means you are carrying your thoughts of your previous life along with you. You are carrying the desires of your previous life along with you. You are carrying the experiences of your previous life along with you. Therefore, when the Atma comes out, that duration, the time of the Atma leaving the body, that determines your next destination. What is the strongest thought, desire at the time of death? That determines where you go in your next life. Krishna says in the Gita, Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam, tyajante anta kalevaram, tam tam eveti kaunteya, sada tad bhava bhavita. Krishna says that whatever smaran, whatever remembrance you have at the time of death, that will determine your next destination. So depending on what thoughts you have, the strongest. So what is the thing that you will remember at the time of death? Your greatest attachments all your life, you will remember the time of death. And therefore, life is a practice and death is an examination. All that you have practiced all your life, you will remember at the time of death. And that will determine your next destination, next body. So, as I said, that the soul is eternal, it never dies, but the body dies. The next question is the soul same as God? The answer is no. The soul is different from God. In fact, many people have this misunderstanding, especially in India, this is so prevalent. People say, Atma Paramatma ek hai. Yeah, people say that Atma Paramatma mein leen ho jata hai, baad mein, gaib ho jata hai. Both the facts are wrong from the Gita perspective. Atma is eternal and it is an eternal associate of God. That means the example that is given is that the Atma is created from God. Just like from a flame, you know, when a huge flame is there, from that flame sparks of fire come out. Similarly, from God, small living entities come out, which is known as the Atma. But just because from fire small sparks come out, doesn't mean that the fire reduces. When from God all of us come out as spirit souls, Atmas, it doesn't mean that God becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. At some point of time, God disappears, you know. Both Atma bana diya, gaib ho gaya bhagwan, you know. It's not like that. The Atma is eternal and so is God. So he can create unlimited Atmas and still he is complete. So, and the difference between God and us is the difference between quantity and quality. All of us are one in quality with God. That means all of us have the same quality like God. Sat, Chit and Ananda. We are all eternal, we are all full of knowledge, and we are all full of bliss. But unfortunately, the difference between us and God is in the quantity. We are infinitesimal and God is infinite. And we are small, very, very insignificant, and God is huge. So, just like a drop in an ocean, if you take the drop of the ocean and you take the entire ocean, the quality of the drop is exactly the same as the quality of the entire ocean. So similarly, the quality of the Atma is exactly the same as the quality of God. But there's a big difference in the quantity. All of us, just like a drop when it falls from the rain, the drop is pure, absolutely pure. But when it falls on the earth, it gets contaminated. Similarly, just like in a computer, the hardware is there and the software is there. But sometimes the software gets corrupted by viruses. Similarly, the Atma, which is within the subtle body, it gets corrupted by wrong desires. When the wrong desires enter into the mind, that is a corruption of the software. And that leads the Atma to a wrong destination, to a wrong direction. And as we create, as we purify ourselves using processes of purification, which we will discuss on day 6, it's like an antivirus program installed, you know. Viruses get deleted and the mind gets purified. So essentially, that's exactly what spiritual life is about, you know, installing antivirus. So the Atma and the spirit soul and God are totally different in quantity, but similar in quality. And then finally, the question is, does the soul change with the changing body? The Atma remains the same. The soul is changeless. Our body changes, but the Atma is exactly the same. The Atma never changes. Though the body constantly keeps changing, the Atma never changes at all. The next question is, what is the size of the Atma? The size of the Atma is explained in the scriptures that if you take a small portion of the hair and you take that small portion of the hair and cut it into 100 parts, and you take one of the 100 parts and cut it further into 100 parts, that 1/10,000th, the tip of the hair, is the size of the soul. Can you imagine how insignificantly small we are? 1/10,000th, the tip of the hair. So small, so minute, so infinitesimal. But the same soul exists in an ant, it exists in an elephant, it exists in a blue whale. Same size. It's not that blue whale has, you know, 1/100th of the size of the hair, you know. No, the Atma is exactly same in size. But the power of the Atma is that when Atma enters into a body, it makes the body flexible. When Atma leaves the body becomes rigid. The power of the Atma is that the Atma has the ability to make the body light. When the Atma leaves the body becomes heavy. And therefore, when a person dies, you need 4 people to carry him. If you have ever handled a dead body, you'll understand what it means, you know. The body becomes so rigid and stiff as soon as the Atma leaves the body. So therefore, the whole understanding is that though the Atma is so infinitesimally small, but because it is a spark of God, it is a part and parcel of God, it has the power to actually animate an entire body, which is gigantic in proportion. So that energy, that spark, which is an emanation from God, is what is our real identity, our eternal identity. So our eternal identity is the fact that we are spirit souls and not the physical bodies. So I'll just quickly summarize everything we spoke. I started the discussion by talking about what is our eternal identity. We said that we are not the body, but we are spirit souls. And then we spoke about three proofs for the existence of the soul. The first proof is logic, which is common sense, introspection and cause and effect. Then we spoke about the second proof, which is science. We spoke about near-death experiences, Michael Sebaum. And we spoke about past life memories, Dr. Ian Stevenson. And then we spoke about, from the scriptural point of view, what the scriptures say. And then we spoke about why we cannot see the soul. To see the soul, there is a process. Just like to see itar and rose or ghee and milk, there is a process. Similarly, to see and experience the soul, there is a process. And if you follow the process, use the procedure, use the apparatus, you will be able to experience the soul. Then we spoke about how we have three bodies. The gross body, which is made up of earth, water, fire, air, ether. The subtle body, which is made up of the mind, intelligence and the false ego. And the spiritual body, which is Sat, Chit and Ananda. Eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. So essentially, these three bodies function according to the chariot body analogy which we discussed. And if you remember, we discussed about the mind intelligence dialogues. And then we spoke about seven FAQs to understand the qualities of the soul. We said that the soul has form. It is not formless. In fact, it gives form to matter. Then we spoke about how the soul is individual. In every person, there is an individual soul that is existing. Then we spoke about how the soul resides in the region of the heart. Then we spoke about how the soul is eternal. It can never be destroyed by weapons. It can never be wet by water. It can never be burnt by fire. So when the body burns in a crematorium, the soul doesn't burn. The soul has already left the body. And in fact, even if the soul is in the body, the soul cannot be burnt along with the body. The soul is just independent of the body. And we saw that the soul and the God and the Atma are same in quality, but different in quantity. So essentially, we are all infinitesimal sparks, small part and parcels of God. But in terms of quantity, we are very, very small, but in quality, we are exactly same. Sat, Chit and Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. And then we saw that the Atma is changeless. Though the body changes with time, the Atma remains eternally same. So therefore, all of us, when we were discussing in the beginning, that everything is changing in our life. Our age is growing, our body is changing, deteriorating, our name may change, our form may change, our relationships may change, our nationality may change, our religion may change, everything may change. But one thing that never changes is the fact that we are the Atma, spirit soul. In fact, one of the most powerful tools or powerful reasons which you can have stability in life in the midst of all changes is this one. Everything in life changes, and when change happens in life, it is very difficult to hold on to, because most people get bewildered when any change happens. Everything in life is going to change for sure, except this one fact, that we are spirit souls. That fact will never change. And the fact that we are eternal, spirit souls is never going to change. So when we hold on to that aspect of life, then there is stability in life. All of us, we're trying to hold on to the body, which is going to change constantly. And every time there's a change, we feel, array, everything slipped out of my hand, you know. And why we feel frustration is because we're trying to hold on to people that change, things that change, situations that change. So the Gita brings us to the foundation of spiritual life, which is holding on to that aspect of life that never changes. The fact that we are spirit souls. It is not going to change in this life, nor it is going to change in any of the future lives. So this is an investment that it is worth investing in. This is an investment that is going to continue for eternally. And finally, we saw the size of the soul as 1/10,000, the tip of the hair. Hare Krishna.